Welcome to The Red-Haired Archaeologist. I am your host, author, and sunscreen advocate, Amanda Hope Haley. Thank you so much for spending some time with me today, studying artifacts our ancient Near Eastern ancestors left behind, and considering if those just might change how we read or read into scripture. So in the last episode, we spent time talking about King Josiah, who is widely remembered as one of the most righteous kings in ancient Israel's history. At the end of his life, he was killed by the Pharaoh Necho out of Egypt. And that reminds us that throughout the entire time that ancient Israel was a nation, it sat at the crossroads of empires. You roughly had Egypt to the south, the Neo-Assyrian Empire to the north and northeast, and then the Neo-Babylonian Empire, which we're going to be talking about today, to the east. All of those empires at times tangoed with the Northern Kingdom and the Southern Kingdom. The Northern Kingdom ended up falling to the Neo-Assyrian Empire long before the Southern Kingdom did. It fell in 722. And then the Southern Kingdom had some form of autonomy in the world as it was, you know, figuring out how to have diplomatic relations with these larger empires around it. They managed to hang on until 586 BCE, when they finally succumbed to Nebuchadnezzar, who was at that time the emperor of the Neo-Babylonian Empire. Well, so after Josiah was killed by the Pharaoh Necho, we have a short period of time where Israel was a vassal state to Egypt. And the final chapter of Chronicles tells us that at that time, Israel was forced to pay really heavy tribute to Egypt, that Josiah's son and his heir, Jehoahaz, he ended up being exiled to Aram, and then he went to Egypt. And then Necho, in place of the person who was supposed to follow Josiah, he ended up placing his brother Eliakim on the throne of Judah, and he actually changed his name then to Jehoiakim. Well, so Egypt really only controlled the Southern Kingdom for about 4 years. And in 605, the Neo-Babylonian Empire, who had been gaining power, who was bumping up against their Neo-Assyrian Empire, their neighbors, their relatives, their sometimes friends to their own north, they end up coming down and, well, actually, they go up into Syria and they meet Necho there. And they have what is called the Battle of Carchemish. And this is a very, very important battle, because in this battle, Nebuchadnezzar, he not only beats the Neo-Assyrians and the Egyptians, but he does it so thoroughly that the Egyptian army, the Egyptian empire, is pushed all the way back to the African continent. So this battle was waged in the area that we know as Syria today. It was all the way up there. That's how far Egypt had increased its reach. Now, scholars will debate exactly why Egypt was up there. There's maybe half and half. Half think that they were up there supporting the Neo-Assyrians and, you know, trying to give them aid as they were fighting against the Neo-Babylonians. Others think that the Neo-Assyrian Empire had already started falling away. The writing was on the wall. They were going to be falling to the Neo-Babylonians, and that actually maybe Egypt was coming up to fill what they saw as a power vacuum that was happening up there. Well, regardless of what Egypt's intentions were or exactly where the power players were at that moment in 605, the result was a man named Nebuchadnezzar ends up vanquishing basically everybody who is there. And it's at this point that we have finally the Neo-Babylonian Empire being the powerhouse in this region. Well, several days after the Battle of Carchemish, word reaches Nebuchadnezzar that his father, Nabopolassar, has died in Babylon. No one really knows exactly why the king wasn't on the battlefield himself. It's possible that he was sick, considering the timeline and all this stuff happened. But his death meant that Nebuchadnezzar, who was at the Battle of Carchemish as the commander-in-chief of the Neo-Babylonian army, he was also the crown prince at that time. This means that he is now the emperor of the Neo-Babylonian Empire. And so he turns around and he goes back to Babylon just as quickly as he possibly can and gets himself crowned there. for fear that there could be some palace intrigue or something like that happening while he's gone. So he rushes back to Babylon and takes over the throne and then just becomes the undisputed ruler of the empire at that time. Now, Nabopolassar was a member of the Chaldean tribe. And the Neo-Babylonian Empire, just like the Neo-Assyrian Empire before them, the empire was formed by lots of groups of different people from different regions in the area. The Chaldeans were one of those groups, one of those sets of tribes that made it up. And when Nabopolassar ends up founding the Neo-Babylonian Empire, as he is followed by his son, Nebuchadnezzar, the people who are in the highest positions in the Babylonian government are Chaldeans. I think that happens. Anytime you have someone new come to power, the people who tend to advise that individual tend to be people that they've known for a long time, that they trust as advisors and as friends. That's exactly what you see happening. And so in the Bible, sometimes when you're reading about the Neo-Babylonian Empire, they're sometimes called the Chaldeans. And that, in the context of the books of Kings and then in the prophets, in those later, historically later books of the Bible, Chaldean is often synonymous with the Babylonian Empire because it was those Chaldeans who were essentially running things from Babylon. Now, at different places in time, that's not necessarily true. If you go back to Genesis, Chaldea is mentioned there. Well, this is long before the Neo-Babylonian Empire or anything like that. And in those early mentions of the Chaldeans, that refers specifically to those smaller tribes that were there at the time. But at this point in history, it's okay if when you're reading the Bible, if you see Chaldeans, then your brain goes, oop, that just means the Babylonians. That's sort of a fair thing to do at that point in history. So how do we know so much about the Neo-Babylonians and actually the Neo-Assyrians before them when there's not a whole lot of detail in the Bible? The Bible mentions a lot of the things that we've been talking about over the last few episodes, but we don't really get specific dates there. We don't get a whole lot of details. Well, there's another set of writings that are really helpful for this, and that is called the Mesopotamian Chronicles. So the Mesopotamian Chronicles, that name has come recently. That is something that scholars call all of the different writings that they have lumped together that came from the empires of Sumer, Assyria and Neo-Assyria, Babylonia and Neo-Babylonia, all of that together. And most of those are cuneiform writing on clay tablets. And so cuneiform, basically you would take a wedge-shaped pen, and instead of using ink and drawing onto a surface, they would take wet clay and press the pen into it and sort of deboss the letters that they were putting onto the tablet. Then the tablets would be dried. Well, so the result is you have all of these tablets that have survived from antiquity because, unlike papyrus and parchment and vellum and all of those other writing materials that we've talked about in the past, these clay tablets, they're prone to breakage, certainly, but they just had a better chance of making it through. And so we have this group of writings from all of these different civilizations that all lived in Mesopotamia from around 1500 BC, from somewhere in the middle of that second millennium, all the way up to 100 BC or BCE. So that's a huge period of time. And within those writings, we get not just historical documents, not just an account of the Battle of Carchemish, but you also get lists of the kings, which are very, very helpful. You get poetry. You have myths. The Epic of Gilgamesh, which you may have heard of before, that's included in what we call the Mesopotamian Chronicles. And so there's songs that are in there, hymns, prayers. And so this source, all of these materials, tell us a lot about the Mesopotamian people, honestly, kind of in a way that the biblical scriptures do for the nation of Israel. Because even in the Bible, we see this blend of narrative work, of stories, of lists of names, all the genealogies that are in the Bible. Of course, we have hymns in the form of the Psalms. We have prayers. We have prophecies. You know, all those kinds of things. And so the Mesopotamian Chronicles are sort of a similar compendium for the Mesopotamian people around the same time that the Bible was being lived out and written and developed. Well, so in the Mesopotamian Chronicles, there is one that is called the Nebuchadnezzar Chronicle, and it accounts for the first 11 years of Nebuchadnezzar's reign. And this, of course, includes the Battle of Carchemish, and it also includes his first attack on what the Chronicles call the city of Judah. It's not that exactly, but that's how most people will translate it today. Well, so in spite of the larger volume of records that we have for the Mesopotamians, they're not completely complete, because we really only have those first 11 years from Nebuchadnezzar. Sadly, we do not have an actual account of what happened the second time that he came to Jerusalem and he decided to conquer the people there. So his annals cut off in 594. And just before that, he invaded what was at that time the Egyptian vassal state of the Southern Kingdom, right? That happened in 597. And when he did that, he basically did the exact same thing that Pharaoh Necho had done several years earlier. He went in, he took the king who was there at the time, Jehoiakim, who had been placed there by Egypt. And 3 months later, he actually does the same thing to that king's son. But he ends up taking them, exiling them to Babylon and plundering Jerusalem. He then appoints his own person to be in charge of Judah at the time, and that is Zedekiah. And he then becomes a sort of vassal king for this area underneath the Neo-Babylonians. So in between Nebuchadnezzar's two invasions of Judah, the one that I just described and the one that we'll get to in just a minute that happened in 586, we actually have found a series of letters. They're not exactly letters, but letters from a city called Lachish. And these letters were written during the time of King Zedekiah, who had been placed on the throne by Nebuchadnezzar. And what they really are is a collection of what archaeologists called ostraca. They are broken pieces of pottery that somebody, an official in the government, went and took time and wrote on. So using ink and a pen, they wrote on these broken pieces of pottery. So these ostraca, which are popularly called the Lachish letters, they regard the functioning of Judahite bases in the area. Lachish would have been a major base at the time. And in these letters, we have descriptions of leaders from Judah traveling into Egypt. We have a story of an unnamed prophet, at least unnamed in those letters, being brought back to Judah from Egypt. There are lots of theories as to who that prophet might be, but the letters themselves don't state it. So what we have with those is basically a window into the operation of life on bases in Judah during this limbo time when Egypt has fallen away, but they obviously still have strong connections with them, and with Judah just trying to survive underneath their new leaders, who are the Neo-Babylonians. Zedekiah ends up reigning for 11 years, and at the end of that 11 years, Nebuchadnezzar, quote, slaughtered everyone without regard to gender, age, or health. They plundered every treasure in the eternal God's temple and burned God's temple to the ground. They stole the king's and the officers' possessions, tore down the wall of Jerusalem, burned the fortified buildings, and destroyed anything of value in Jerusalem. Anyone who managed to survive the invasion was exiled to Babylon, where they remained servants of the Babylonian court until it was conquered by the Persian Empire. That is 2 Chronicles 36, 17 through 20. Now, in 2 Kings, we get a slightly different description of what happened there. And it says that the commander, quote, spared the poorest people and left them to take care of the land as farmers and gardeners. That description reminds us of what we had already seen happen with the Northern Kingdom when the Assyrian Empire came in. It was very, very common that when empires would come into a place, they would take the powerful residents, like the king and his advisors, military commanders. They would take anybody who had any sort of power, any sort of sway over the population, and they would exile them. But they would leave behind the poorer people, the people who they deemed did not have a lot of political clout among their own people, so that those people could stay there and take care of things. Because we have the two different accounts, the reality is probably somewhere in the middle. We talk about Nebuchadnezzar coming in and absolutely flattening Jerusalem, and that is the description that we get in Chronicles. But even with the city coming down, the city did not exist alone. A city at the time would have been walled, but then outside of those city walls, there would have been pastures, there would have been agricultural life, and it would have been in the interest of any empire coming in to keep those areas fertile, to keep them being productive so that taxes could continue to be paid and all that sort of thing. And so it is likely that not absolutely every single person in the region was sent into exile, but that some people were left behind to just sort of monitor these things. And in fact, next week, we're going to meet some of those groups of people. So there's a little tease for next week, which will actually be the final episode of this podcast. Well, so what happened there? What happened with Nebuchadnezzar coming in and just completely destroying Jerusalem? It's frequently referred to as the fall of Jerusalem. And it's not only important for Israelite history, but to archaeology and to history as a whole, because the fall of Israel in 586 on archaeological calendars, that actually marks the end of the Iron Age. So 586, that date has lived in infamy. So how do we know that it happened in 586? Because, of course, the Bible at that time is not counting dates in the ways that we do today. The Babylonian Chronicles, or the Mesopotamian Chronicles, which are much better about dating everything, as I just said, they cut off after only 11 years. We only get that first conquest of Nebuchadnezzar. We do not have a description in the Babylonian Chronicles of what happened to Egypt in 586. Well, so where scholars get the number from is from the one resource that we do have, and that is the Hebrew Bible. And so we're told there that this destruction happened in the 11th year of Zedekiah's reign, which was also the 19th year of Nebuchadnezzar's reign at the end of a 2-year-long siege. And so just doing that math, everybody, most people agree it was either 586 or 587 when this conquest actually happened. And in archaeology and honestly in history, when you're looking at thousands and thousands of years of time, a 1-year difference between 586 or 587, that's not a huge amount at all. So, you know, right in that area is likely when this occurred. And all we can hope as readers of the Bible, as students of history, is that over time, we're going to end up getting more documents. I think there's a good chance that somewhere out there, there is more to the Nebuchadnezzar Chronicle than we've been able to read before. And as I've said in other episodes, I hope that there will be a time when we can find other Israelite records that are referenced in Samuel and Kings, those books of the kings of Israel or the books of the kings of Judah, all of those other resources that are mentioned that we simply don't have. So I just hope that one day all of this will come to light and, you know, we can know with even more certainty. In 2 Kings, we are given an extensive list of everything that was captured or destroyed in the temple. Every single object that you could think of is mentioned there. Everything from, you know, the columns to the utensils that were used for worship practices. Everything that is mentioned is there, except for the one thing that you would expect to be mentioned there, and that is the Ark of the Covenant. So during the first temple period, or at least for most of it, the Ark of the Covenant sat within the Holy of Holies, and it was God's footstool on earth. The thought being that, you know, he is up in heaven, but he's resting his feet here in earth. It is what connects his heavenly realm to the earthly realm. The Shekinah glory exists above the Ark of the Covenant. It is crucial to Judaic religion at the time. But you obviously wouldn't have the Bible without God. And this creation of his Ark of the Covenant is very, very important to Israelite history. And then subsequently to Jewish history and Christian history. So it's really surprising that in the list of everything that's plundered from the temple, that's not mentioned. Well, so a lot of people have over the years tried to figure out, you know, what did it look like? And probably the most famous mock-up, if you will, of the Ark of the Covenant is Steven Spielberg's vision that that was in Indiana Jones and the Raiders of the Lost Ark. That was an imagining based on the text that we have. But there is a church in Ethiopia that actually claims that they have the Ark of the Covenant. It is an Ethiopian Orthodox church, and this is a giant tradition for them. It's incredibly important. I referenced this a little bit in episode 4, and the story of how on earth the Ark of the Covenant could have ended up in Ethiopia, which seems really, really strange on the face of it, that story comes to us from a document that's called The Glory of the Kings. And in The Glory of the Kings, which The Glory of the Kings is sort of the listing of all of the different kings and queens throughout the history for them. There is a story in there that the Queen of Sheba went up into Israel. She met King Solomon. This is recorded in the Bible too, at least that part of it is. Her visit is recorded. Well, The Glory of the Kings and these later traditions go on to say that they had a lovely night together and ended up having a son who was named Menelik. And she went home, had her son at home, and then years later, Menelik traveled back to meet his father. And while he was there, he ended up getting just a retinue of people to come around him. And as they were returning to Ethiopia, he realized that these people had spirited away the Ark of the Covenant. And Menelik decides that since no one who did that, nobody who spirited it away in the night, since none of those people were actually killed, then it must have been God's will for him to take care of this. So that's sort of the root story behind why the Ark might be in Ethiopia. Sadly, there are a lot of reasons that, you know, maybe that is a tradition and not exactly historical. And sort of the first red flag there is The Glory of the Kings actually wasn't written until the 1300s AD or CE. It is, as ancient texts go, it's a relatively new one. And it may be based on something that comes from the 300s, but, you know, we can't be certain of that either. There's obviously years of oral tradition that are involved there, but it is a very, very late document to hang such an important piece of history upon. And maybe the bigger thing that makes the assertion that the Ark of the Covenant is an axiom, maybe the bigger issue is actually that no one, there's one person on earth at a time who is allowed to see it, and that is the guardian of the Ark. And so all of the people who are high up even in the Ethiopian Orthodox Church, they have never seen it. No one has ever seen it before. And of course, that raises questions as to why. Why would they be keeping it, you know, behind closed doors, all of that kind of stuff. So that, though it is one of the most popular traditions as to where it would be, you know, maybe it's not the best, most likely historical explanation of where it ended up. Jewish commentators, a thousand years, about 1,000 years or more even before The Glory of the Kings was written, you have Jewish commentators coming up with other theories. Some believe that it was actually spirited away under Manasseh. You remember us talking about him. He is that evil king who inexplicably ruled the longest of anybody. Under Manasseh, it is some believe that he engineered it being spirited away to Ethiopia. So there could be a connection between those two traditions there. Others say that it simply went to Babylon when the temple was plundered, that somehow when they were taking everything else, it got swept up and it made its way over there too. But those are just other theories. In 2 Maccabees, which is an apocryphal text. If you are Catholic, then you believe that it is part of the Bible. For Protestants like me, it is. I consider the Maccabees to be really helpful historical books, but they don't have the spiritual weight for Protestants that they would for Catholics. Well, in 2 Maccabees, you get the story of the prophet Jeremiah concealing it in Mount Nebo. So maybe to me, that is the most plausible because of where the story comes from, because of the age of the story. Maybe it's in Mount Nebo somewhere. There are certainly people who have been looking for it there for a long time. But there's even more stories than that. There's even a British tradition that says that the Knights Templar, when they were over fighting the Crusades, a group of them found themselves at Petra, and they discovered it at Petra. They took it from Petra, took it back to England. And in this tradition, it says that actually the Ark of the Covenant right now is in storage at a place called Hardwick. And the thing that makes a lot of people think maybe this is true is that this particular estate is actually part, it's actually controlled by the British Ministry of Defense right now. So I'm unclear as to why that might be the case. Odds are it has absolutely nothing to do with the Ark of the Covenant. But the point is, there are traditions all over the world who have developed stories as to what may have happened to the Ark of the Covenant. And really, none of them have a scriptural backing to them. In the Bible itself, the Ark of the Covenant simply ceases being discussed. And that's where we're left. We're left to wonder. And so for me as a scripture reader, I want to stop right there. The search for specific artifacts, artifacts that are mentioned in the Bible, but that haven't been discovered through scientific excavation. Those stories of expeditions to find the Ark of the Covenant or Noah's Ark, or maybe even moving into relics, the cup of Christ. Those things that people get fixated on, they make for really great adventure stories. Indiana Jones and the Last Crusade, I'm sure at some point in my early life, I must have seen that, and it must have had an impact on me that led me to this career, that led me to what I am doing today. I'm thankful for movies like that because they bring attention to the field of archaeology. But when we get so incredibly fixated on finding really spectacular things, then the spirit of archaeology is lost. Sometimes I've had the opportunity to talk about how archaeology began. And in the late 1800s and early 1900s, you see people going into the Holy Land and looking for fabulous objects. They're doing their work at a time before archaeology had really developed as a scientific endeavor. And they are over there. Maybe they're over there with great intentions, trying to prove the Bible, trying to find things. Maybe they're just over there because they want cool things for their own collections, or they want cool things for museums, or they want to preserve these very important artifacts for humanity for centuries and millennia to come so that we can go and see them and understand our ancestors better. Those people and the stories that come out of that time, sadly, that is, I think, something that archaeology is still working against today. Archaeology as a field has become so much more scientific. We see the use of scientific objects in the field. Dating is done with the use of strata. And most importantly of all, when archaeologists go out into the field, they shouldn't be going out looking for anything specific. The whole idea is to go out there, put your spade, put your trowel down into the ground, and see what comes up. And after artifacts have been excavated in a scientific way, as they're coming up, we take pains to catalog what was around them, where in time we think this happened, based on associations within one tell and associations, putting different tells together. That's how we track when people like Nebuchadnezzar came through and destroyed areas, because fire leaves these thick destruction layers that help with dating. Archaeology is very meticulous. It's very scientific. And when really cool things are found, that's great for the field because it captures people's attention. But so often, those really cool objects that we're out there looking for that, as of right now, have not been found yet, if we actually did find them, if we actually did find the Ark of the Covenant, it would be spectacular. And I mean that in the literal sense of the word. It would be an absolute spectacle. People from all over the world would come to see what these artifacts looked like, I would be first among them in line to do that exact thing. They would be spectacular. However, how helpful would actually finding those objects be? Because archaeology, and specifically biblical archaeology, exists not to prove the Bible. It exists simply to help us understand the ancient world better, to understand people better, to understand civilizations better, and then I would argue to help us understand scripture better. Because we want to know what the ancient world looked like. And the only way that we can really figure that out is through proper scientific education. And so good archaeology is when archaeologists go over there and they just, their minds are as blank as they can possibly be, and they are digging and trying to do it with an open mind. And then after things come out of the ground, after things have been well cataloged, then at that point, that's when the interpretation can begin. Once you have an object come out of the ground that is, maybe really, really cool, and maybe you look at this particular object and think, oh, I think this was in a temple or something like that. You catalog everything, and then later over time, as experts look at it, then you start to be able to make those associations with the Bible so that we can understand the Bible better. It's not about proving the Bible. It's not about being Indiana Jones and killing Nazis. It's not about adventure. It's about the people and the civilizations that created all these documents. Now, I'm going to assume that that little bark there was Copper agreeing with me and offering his support. Join me next week for the final episode of Season 4, when we discuss the Babylonians' own defeat by the Persian Empire, learn how the exile changed the Israelites into Jews, and follow the Jews as they return to Jerusalem and rebuild it and their culture. The Red-Haired Archaeologist podcast is researched, written, and recorded by me, Amanda Hope Haley. It is edited by Tanya Yurinkov. New episodes are released each Thursday. To interact with me and other listeners, make sure you click the follow button on the Red-Haired Archaeologist pages on Facebook and Instagram, and subscribe to my channel on YouTube. Then check out my website at redhairedarchaeologist.com, where you can subscribe to my monthly email, order signed copies of all my books, and schedule me to come speak in your town.